truth is out there. And tonight I'm by myself. This is kind of a off-schedule episode of I Want to Believe, but I had a pretty special guest with me tonight. And that special guest would be a friend of mine who I've talked about extensively on the show before. We've got a lot of history, a lot of incidents that have happened to us personally. So tonight I want to welcome Brandon Maker.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's kind of nice to finally have something half-ass formal here. Instead of our just lunch discussions and regular discussions on the phone. So, yeah we'll get into some whatever. It's your show, you know, whatever you want to talk about.
Sounds good. Like, I'm no expert by
any means, but I've got my opinions, and you know, we'll throw them out there and share some of my experiences and our experiences.
Yeah. Like you said, a lot of the conversations we've had in the past have been topics on the show. And generally, if I go into a subject that I'm not 100% or even 50% comfortable in, I'll call Brandon up and I'll go have a dinner meeting with him. And we'll sit and talk for 3 or 4 hours about just this stuff. And I know one of the big topics we'll talk about tonight is the 37th parallel, which is everybody who listens to the show knows. Was one of my favorite topics to talk about. We did a whole episode on it. And my love for that topic comes from Brandon. He's the one that told me about this and really pointed me in this direction, and it's been amazing so far. So, I guess first thing I want to start off with is kind of exciting, and it is involved in the paranormal research field, especially with extraterrestrials. Project Blue Book has been announced for a third season. They released the trailer tonight for History Channel. And I gotta say that with the government opening up more about these actual UFO sightings that are happening, like actually confirming that, yeah, this was a UFO, that this show is coming out, and you know, maybe we're gonna start getting more information. Like, it just seems like every year we're getting more information.
Absolutely, I agree.
Especially, I mean, when you have these different researchers out there, people who are with, you know, big names are out here trying to do this stuff. We got Tom DeLonge, who is out here doing the Lord's work, as I call it, because that man is coming up with everything possible, and he's leaving no stone unturned. And that's Shannon's personal hero. He really wants me to try to get him on the show sometime soon, so I'm going to try that. I'll see what happens. Brandon,
that'd be big, yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah, we've got some big names coming on the show soon. Obviously, everybody knows Scott Walters. Been on the show. He's coming back. Probably, we're recording this on a Friday night. Going to post on a Saturday. He'll be on the show Sunday. So we're going to have two, I Want to Believe, this weekend. I know I've reached out to Chuck Stokowski. Anybody who's a UFO extraterrestrial research fan knows who he is. I believe he hosted two shows on Travel Channel. I think it's what channel it was on. And he's happy to be on the show. We can't wait to get him on. Margie Kay, the vice president for the MUFON chapter of Missouri, is going to be on the show with us. So big things coming for Podzilla and the paranormal field.
And of course, those are two contacts you just talked about. The Chuck's sister. And,
yes.
Missouri MUFON director. At least she used to be. I don't know if she still is. Debbie Ziegelmeyer. That would be and she's a very, very incredible speaker. I've heard several podcasts from her and a couple YouTube videos that I've seen of her. Very, very articulate, and has had some personal experiences that have seemed to be directed at her and her family that are very unique, and you need to hear those sometime.
Definitely. I have to see if I can.
I want to say she's somewhere in the Imperial Festus, Peebles, somewhere in there.
Somewhat local.
Almost local for us. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is always cool, because I love these people who are well known for this topic, or these topics in this area are kind of fascinating for me, because it falls into the category of the 37th parallel. They call it the paranormal highway, and my God, is this not just one of the busiest intersections on that highway in this area? The countless stories that have happened just in Cape, or in the Cape area. So Brandon, what got you interested in the 37th parallel? Like, what was the thing that actually got you studying the topic of it?
Well, I think it first became noted in, I think, late 2014 is when that Unexplained Files episode of the Paranormal Highway came on. That's when I was first introduced to Zukowski, when I was seeing that episode. And actually the Piedmont part that's involved in that, I had been making, with working with the Red Cross, we make with two blood drives a year at the high school and maybe three at the Masonic Lodge, yeah. Incidentally, at the Piedmont. So even before I'd seen that, being able to talk to Piedmont locals was really unique, and then having that tied in there. And, of course, Mo 41, the Cape Girardeau crash, is briefly tied into that, and there's not, you know, there's not a lot of mainstream attention brought to that.
Which is shocking because, I mean, this is, here you have the actual first confirmed case of a crashed UFO, and it's right here in Cape Girardeau, but they only ever talk about Roswell.
Right.
And like, so we had Paul Blake Smith, the author of MO-41, and I remember asking him, you know, you think they would have been better trained, as well as they handled the Cape Girardeau case and covering it up, how did they screw up so bad on Roswell? And he didn't really have a good answer, because there's not really a good answer. It makes no sense of how that was such a mess up out there. But one person's reporting, it blew it open, and now Roswell is
exactly.
For those who don't know what, when he's talking about Piedmont, the event he's talking about is what's called the Piedmont Lights. It is a very, very peculiar case, very interesting, and that was over a period of time too. That wasn't just a one night experience, was it?
No, it was in 1973. And I want to say it was over about a 3-month period, maybe like a April, May, June. I could be wrong, but it was around 3 months worth of it. And actually even a couple of years that there was residual activity there, but there was a peak. There was a few days that was an absolute to where it was just guaranteed, like on schedule, that people were able to go out and be able to see these lights and see activity, actually predict almost as if it was choreographed in the sky. That the residents there could tell you now these five lights are about to start making a figure eights, or, you know, something intelligent that response that day. And that's where the where Hartley Rutledge, this group SEMO, where Project Identification came from, them actually bringing in not just people from SEMO, but other institutions, astronomers, astrophysicists that came out and kind of took part in that. Because it just sounded like a bunch of BS until Harley apparently got on the horn and said, "No, this is really going on, and we need some people to see this." You know, apparently they've had this. It's been filmed. There's been audio recordings, drafts done of it, illustrations, and I know you're looking in. Being able to read a little bit of Project Identification. You can only see little snippets of pages.
I actually have it pulled up on Amazon right now. So what he's talking about here is Professor Rutledge wrote a book about the whole project, about more than just the Piedmont Lights, but it's talked about heavily in the book. It is actually called Project Identification. I'm looking at it on Amazon right now, and there's two copies of the paperback. They are going for $210 a piece. So that's a bucket list book to buy off of Amazon. So maybe one day. But yeah, I'm definitely still trying to get my hands on a copy of it just to look at it. And it's so hard to find. You would think SEMO's got a copy of it. And I've had three different SEMO students check in the libraries, and apparently there's not a copy anywhere. Which surely there is. Maybe they just have it under lock and key. Honestly, that may be a question I talked to Joel about. Maybe he may be able to get us a better answer on it.
Yeah. So yeah, that would be neat.
I mean, it's, and the book actually says, like, it comes with photographs and diagrams showing some of the events that happened that day. Am I mistaken in thinking that one of the trips he took out there with his students, they were actually set up lights and were communicating with these UFOs in the sky?
Yeah. Right. They apparently, I guess before we really used a binary, they used a system of flashing lights. I guess it would be more of a Morse code type. and they were, the lights would replicate exactly what they were doing. Car would give an extended response, something to that effect.
Yeah, so
I can't be 100% sure on exactly how, what the responses were, but that's just kind of how I perceived the way that they explained it.
Yeah, and it comes down to it was an intelligent response for something that was in the sky that really shouldn't have been there, you know, unless this is real. It's a fun topic. It has been. I'm looking forward to more of this. I'm definitely looking forward to Chuck Zukowski being on the show because I want to get more in depth in it. Like I said, we covered a whole episode on the 37th parallel and how, you know, all these different phenomenons around the world fall within this 37th parallel area. I'm talking even Roanoke, the colony of Roanoke, it lays within the boundary of the 37th. It goes from there to all the way across America, and it's just if you can think of any well-known extraterrestrial event happening in America, it's probably going to fall on there. I'm pretty sure like Skinwalker Ranch, or at least parts of it, fall within that boundary. I don't know if you knew that or not.
Skinwalker's a little bit north of that. So an easy way to picture the 37th parallel is that is actually the USGS border line at Four Corners. So mm-hmm. the south border of Utah and Colorado and north border of Arizona and New Mexico are directly on this 37th parallel. So that kind of gives you, if you can draw that line over there and all the way over to the east coast, it's around the Virginia Beach areas where that comes out in that metropolitan area, and then all the way over to the Bay Area, like right through San Jose, actually. And incidentally, Winchester Mystery House is right on that. So not UFO, but that's pretty interesting that that's on that.
Well, it's not. Well, and that's something I talked about in that episode. It's not just extraterrestrial events that are happening on this 37th parallel. It's everything. You have paranormal field, like the full paranormal field of research is happening on this line. You have cryptozoology. You have spiritual phenomena. You have aliens. It's all happening here. The Bell Witch, that whole incident, that lies somewhere close to the 37th parallel.
Yeah, it's just a little bit south of there. Edgar Casey, for example, Hopkinsville,
Kentucky.
And his hospital was Virginia Beach.
Oh, you know what? I completely forgot about that.
Yeah.
Huh.
So, and there's a little other something that's in between those two. And that's in government, totally government connected, was the Greenbrier Hotel in West Virginia.
Okay, so fill me in on this one.
That's the Greenbrier Hotel. Yeah, absolutely. You need to Google this. And once you see it, it'll refresh your memory.
Okay.
But that's essentially the, let's say, the doomsday capital, the bunker that was in clandestine was created with in a operational hotel. Picture the Stanley Hotel, put it out in the West Virginia mountains in Appalachia, put that out there, and without anybody knowing, that completely worked at a hotel staff of 100 people, absolutely oblivious that the government was building a underground Washington DC, Cheyenne Mountain. Underneath that hotel in the mountain.
How do you get by doing that without anybody knowing?
That's where the critics that talk about the Dulce base on 37th parallel. Well, how in the hell can we get by with nobody? Well, one thing, that's in the middle of the desert. That's a little bit of a, you know, it's a different story there, let alone be going on with an operational hotel. Obviously, there was construction that was going on, but they could come up with some BS story that everybody bought and were still just oblivious, and just everybody thought nothing of it. And so you could probably, once you study this, you could probably create an entire podcast in regards to the Greenbrier Hotel once you do your research. But it goes pretty deep. Now, literally, it's deep, but I mean, there is a lot to that. And there has to be, there has hypothetically there's a there's several other Greenbrier hotels out there that we have no idea about that will probably end up being exposed at some point.
Yeah.
So yeah, whenever you get the opportunity, look that up. But 37th parallel, nonetheless.
Yeah, that may be something me and Shannon have to sit down and do because he's when it comes to government conspiracies, he is the one. Like I'm a conspiracy theorist to an extent, but when it comes to government, that's all him, and that definitely falls in that category. I'm trying to picture the moving of, you know, what had to be hundreds of thousands of tons of rock out of this, you know, quarrying out of this mountain to build this. Like how does that go unnoticed? It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but I don't know.
Yeah, actually, in my notes, I wrote this down. The Greenbrier Hotel is at 37 degrees and 47 minutes. So that's probably about the equivalent of, I'm trying to think what direction I'm going here. Carbondale, maybe?
Yeah.
So that's probably where that would lay. Winchester Mystery House, I wrote that note right above that. 37 degrees and 19 minutes. So that's pretty freaking close. Just a few miles off of the line itself.
Yeah, I always love to point out the fact when talking about the 37th, that perfect 37, like 37.000, runs directly through Cairo. And not only does it run directly through Cairo, it also runs directly through one of the most haunted buildings in Cairo.
Oh yeah, absolutely, the Masonic Lodge.
Yeah,
lays. Yeah, yeah. 0 minutes and 0 seconds that sucker lays on.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I'm still working on trying to get in there. They've had so many leadership changes in the fraternity over the last few years. But I'm hoping soon, like maybe even after all this pandemic is over, we can get in there.
Yeah, well, just Cairo in general has been, that's such a shame that the paranormal ideas just became such a taboo thing. To it. And it's kind of like my buddy Richard, like he talks to people, talk about these things for it all. This is the Bible Belt. Well, no, he's like, look how places like New Orleans, embraces it. Savannah, yeah. Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina, absolutely embrace their paranormal history.
Yeah.
And it's just completely local leadership, arrogance, just, narcissism. In general, that took Cairo down to begin with.
Well, and we've got people in right now who are trying to change that, especially with some of this stuff. I was recently voted into a ghost hunting team out of Tennessee that I met randomly one night after working a dispatch shift at the police department. Was happened to be driving by the old hospital in Cairo, and I see some person I'd never seen walking out front. I'm like, well, that's weird. No one's ever out here this time of night. Because most people in Cairo are scared of the hospital. So I turn around, go back, and I go to the back door, and I see cars out there, and I see a light on inside. So I call the police department, talk to one of the officers, and he says, yeah, the county gave him permission to go in there. It's a bunch of ghost hunters from Tennessee. And I'm thinking that might be the beginning of a breakthrough for things like that in Cairo, mainly because one of the main people who was always against any paranormal research happening in town no longer really has any pull in the city. And you know who it is. I'm not going to mention any names.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we've got more leadership in town now that's a little bit more open-minded to the things like that. I mean, you know, they may not be want to be involved in it personally, but they're more willing to listen to it if it's going to help bring some kind of revenue to the city, and it can. Just in tax revenue, somebody opens up a business in town or opens up some kind of business in town where the property is haunted, and there's a lot of it in Cairo, and they start doing, you know, things like Lent Mansion does, or with a hospital, something like Waverly Hills does. People pay to go in these places and spend the night and do ghost hunts. Well, that's a taxable income base for these cities that they're just missing out on. And that hospital in Cairo, while filthy and it'd be easy to clean up, and the building itself is structurally sound. There's absolutely no reason we couldn't use it for something like that. We've got new owners of the River Lore. I'm getting ready to try to get in contact with them. For those who don't know, the River Lore is a Victorian style house in Caro. When was it built, Brandon?
It was after the Civil War.
Yeah.
I want to say it's an 1880-ish. It was one of the Halliday homes. It's a beautiful Second Empire structure.
But it's got a dark history. A small dark history, but it is. There was a house fire there at one point in time, and someone who actually lived there died in the house fire. And I'm sure things have happened there in the past that I personally don't know about yet, but that's one of the stories that I remember being told as a kid. And you know, I remember Steve, my neighbor Steve Williams, who was a firefighter who trained both of us and the stuff like that, that, you know, him telling me the story of the woman dying in the front room of the house there. Again, it was owned by the city for the past 25 years.
Yeah, I'd say 20 years.
Yeah, and
the Walter family was the last one to leave it, and the city acquired it.
And it went to waste.
There's no doubt about it. If it would set another year, I would say it would be in such bad disrepair that they would have had no choice but to just let it fall down.
Well, I tell you what,
it would be uninhabitable. There would be no way.
Yeah.
That anybody could, without, you know, $5 million in renovation, probably fix it.
Well, if you ever get a chance,
I'm sure they're spending a pretty penny right now, just doing a little bit they're fixing now.
But they're doing amazing. It looks great. It's still got a long way to go, but it's looking really good. The yard in the place was a complete jungle, so much so you couldn't see the house. And now you can. They've got the shrubberies cut down. They got all the trees cut down, and it's coming together. It's going to be amazing. But I guess we can use these topics that we're talking about here to kind of segue into something else we wanted to talk about. Personal experiences we've had, and my guy, we've had a lot of personal experiences together and separately. And I told you before the show, the only experience that we've shared that I've talked about on the show was a mezzanine man from the fire department. And I only talked about that because it was brought up for the Ghosts of the Mississippi show that we did with what is his name, that radio channel over there? Is it KROX or?
KRCU, the university.
Yes, it KRCU, yeah.
University's radio station, is that it?
Yeah, that's it, yeah. We did it with Professor Joel Rhodes from SEMO, and it was a blast. I think just our segment won some kind of award for that year.
Yeah, that won the Ghost of the Mississippi, that won the Missouri Broadcasters Association their documentary of the year.
Yeah, and it was fun making. We actually took them on tours of the. First of all, we went to the Custom House, which we'll talk about that here in a minute, which is, and then they came back to the fire department. We actually sat and did the interviews, and, it was fun doing, even if they did get my name wrong.
Yeah.
I remember going back and finally listening to it.
All the time. Yeah. People were doing that all the time. I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, we look nothing alike and we act nothing alike, but
yep,
here we
all
are.
All opposites. And yeah.
Yeah. So, I know one of the stories you're wanting to talk about. I was there. I didn't actually see it. The closest involvement I had to it was grabbing Tubby, telling him not to go do anything dumb. But I'll let you tell this story since you were a personal witness to it.
Okay, so Roslyn Hotel fire. So the Roslyn Hotel, and, you know, we don't have anybody really left in Caro. That are good historians. Now, Steve Williams is probably our best. He was born in 1942. It existed then, but the Roslyn was a, if you would look at it at this, in this era, that whenever, let's say the 10 years ago when this building existed, if you see the stereotypical slums of Brooklyn, Queens, that little thing that, you come into America, that's those apartments that, Akeem and Simi moved into. This is that's like the epitome of what I'm talking about, this type of building. But at one time, that building was a relatively, I want to say luxurious actually. We did have Caro, and I say we, Caro, the Hotel Caro and Holiday Hotel. Those would be the equivalents of like the Waldorf and the Plaza at the time. And then kind of a, let's say that would be a four-star hotel would be like the Roslyn and what was the Burning Hotel, almost an identical building that was on the other corner just north of that. Was, and it, that was before, I barely remember, and it was, it burned down before you was born, but I do remember that building existing, so that burned in, I'm going to say the late 80s, mid to late 80s or so, but I do remember, I don't remember the fire, but I remember the shell of the building that was still there, but yeah. Those were those hotels that just transients come through, and when Caro was, had a booming economy. Matter of fact, I did hear a story. I worked at Daystar in the late 90s, and there was a resident there that had actually, when the Roslyn turned over to apartments, had actually lived there. And he says as a kid, he can remember that's where Howard Hughes would stay when he apparently he did a lot of business dealings in Caro and frequented Caro. And however, with his as much of a hermit, that or you know, whatever you want to call him, that the extreme introvert that he was, that he with all his money, he did not want to stay in the Hotel Caro. He didn't want to stay in the Holiday Hotel, and he chose the Roslyn. So that's kind of their claim to the fame is this is where Howard Hughes preferred this. But ultimately, that ended up becoming just a an actual turned into one of these hourly rates type. Facilities, yeah. The red neon, and then it just slowly just turned into just slumlord apartments into there, and just gradually just went to where it became just a pure ghetto. And the owners before Roslyn and her daughter Cabrini were absolutely wonderful people, even modern day saints. If you would, the way yeah. that they had taken care of people, and regardless of your ability to pay, your lifestyle, your past history, that they took anybody in, it almost became a homeless shelter. There were people that were in there that were paying whatever they could, their $20 a month, what have you, to be able to stay there. But that's the type of place it ended up being. I lived from being 12 years old, and living in the same building, building I lived in across the street, there was three separate apartments throughout that. My parents built an entire house above their business, and there was two efficiency apartments that were in there. So between living in between those three apartments, you know, and long after they moved out and having the front apartment and just watching the demise of that place, you know, I got to see it not quite in its heyday, but I really seen the demise of that place. And seen a lot of crime there. I watched a lot of dead bodies being carried out of there. Heard a lot of gunshots in there. I never, with the fire department or with the ambulance, I never went to a gunshot. Went to a couple stabbings in there. Seen a lot of bloodshed in there. So it's kind of interesting. You know, I got off on a tangent with the history of that place, but, I guess that will kind of, intertwine with the story. So one night I hear the engine come by. It's not uncommon. Caro Fire Department was pretty busy. No, I didn't hear anything on the radio.
We were hammering calls back in the day.
Yeah. Whenever you look at the demographics of what the Caro Fire Department used to do was, you know, pretty comparable to, you know, we used to compare it to Cape with a tenth of the population, that the call volume or the actual structure fires that we worked would be the equivalent to the Cape Fire Department working 400 working structure fires a year. Mm-hmm. That's how much that we ran. And of course we had that one ambulance in the middle of the county. So the medical calls, the dumpster fires, what have you. You know, where Caro Fire Department was going to 600, one engine was going to 600 calls a year, you know, running the entire town. So I actually, it was not uncommon for me to hear a cue siren. I never heard a page. So here the engine blows by, and I thought they were going out of town. I paid no attention to what was going on. And that's when Officer Sergeant Kirk Snelson was ringing my doorbell, I mean frantically, and beating on it. And I ran downstairs, and all I could hear him say is, "Hey, get over there. Rico went in there. And I'm like, "What?" And I'm still not. I could see the lights flashing at that point. I just see ugly green smoke. And that's an ugly backdraft.
Yep.
Oxygen star smoke coming from the basement of the Roslyn. And at that time, there was a couple other officers that were there. The lights were on there. And all he was telling me is, he said, "Rico went inside there." And I'm like, "What the?" Oh, and this is without me having any gear, running across the streets, kind of sizing up the situation. And I see an 1¾-inch hose line running up it's second floor, but consider that the main level. It had one of these walk-in type basements, stairs on each side of the little, maybe 3 or 4 steps that go down to the lower level.
Yeah.
If you call that the ground level or whatever you would call that. That's where the fire seemed to be. It seemed to be a basement fire, in my opinion, that there was something on fire in that basement. Now, there were no windows existing on there. The next owners went through and had taken sheet metal, bolted over those, so you couldn't, there was no way to ventilate that. And I look at this and I go, "You've got to be kidding me that he's went inside that." And he went through the main level, which would require you to go all the way to the back of the apartment building, where the stairs were, mm-hmm. and downstairs, versus why in the hell didn't he just go? If he was intended on going this, another thing is he's by himself, completely alone.
Which is very taboo in the fire industry.
It's absolute suicide. That's an absolute no-no. There's been times that I had done it, but it was maybe a shotgun house and a single room on fire in the back. I know that there's someone, 30 seconds behind me maybe, but no, he blindly went in there. And immediately I got on the evacuation just universally in fire service, 3 long blasts on the air horn tells everybody to evacuate. So mm-hmm. I got out and did that. And then I start seeing the hose start backing up. I'm pulling on the hose, and apparently he had made it all the way to the back steps, but did not open that door. And there's absolutely no doubt in my mind, even though a backdraft is an extremely rare occurrence that, I had never, out of well over, let's say, 200 working structure fires, I've never personally seen a backdraft happen. But everything that you are taught, absolutely all the telltale signs, the color of the smoke, the pressure of the smoke, the way it was sucking in and out like that.
It's a fire that's burning in a place that starved of oxygen. As soon as you would open that door, it would have just fed it, and then it would have been bad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and there's no doubt in my mind that he would not have made it out of there. And there would be no way that we could go in and retrieve him either. And so, anyway, whenever we get him out there, we're like, what the hell were you thinking? And really his honest question his answer was, "I don't know." He said, "That fire wasn't there." He was kind of stumbling with his words and almost as if he had a stroke or something. It was just very bizarre the way that things were going. Fortunately, this fire had self-ventilated from somewhere. It may have been a small backdraft, but it wasn't the Hollywood explosion of it. Finally, all that gray smoke, a green smoke, I should say, sucked back in. And then fire just kind of pressurized fire blew out a few windows. Not a big spectacular scene, but it finally lit itself up. But yeah, there's no doubt in my mind he would have went to the back and opened that basement door or that stairway door. But yeah, it would have lit his ass up. Yeah. So the fire chief gets there, the building inspector gets there. We call Mound City, Tim's, Olive Branch, our Horseshoe Lake Fire Department.
And Wickliffe.
All showed up. And Wickliffe Fire Department all show up. We're preparing. This is a big building. We have an exposure there to the south side. Fortunately, it's a stucco house. But it is still, maybe 8 feet away from it.
Yeah.
So, and that was the thing that a lot of times that we did was it in Caro, whenever you have a, if you put out, halfway put out one of these fires, One thing you're going to be babysitting it for 3 or 4 days. It's going to rekindle. We're going to keep going back and forth to it. Then you've got half a structure there.
And then you're going to have people coming back to reset it.
You're going to, yeah. And you've got the chance of people, us being liable, of the building collapsing. And then the cost of them tearing it down, the city obviously can't afford to tear it down. So a lot of times the call is made just to go ahead and let the structure burn down. You have to have the chief, the building inspector, and especially if you can get the owner there. It's always red flags that they have insurance on it and they didn't. So whenever you don't have, especially when you don't have insurance, the owner typically has nothing to gain other than it's a derelict structure and they need it down. You know, big deal if it's not going to hurt anybody, if nobody's going to get injured from this and no other property is going to get damaged. You know, I'm fine with it. That's just the way things were. Yeah. So when we're talking about protecting the exposure, we ended up having a mobile deck gun, the Blitz Fire, which is just that 1 3-inch line that runs to it, still flows, you know, 500 gallons a minute on there. We had one hand line on there. So the second floor, the main level, started igniting. It started igniting from the back. So we would have one apartment going up, blowing flames. It would vent itself out, and everything in that room would flash over. So everything, when a flashover occurs, that means everything in that room reaches its ignition temperature all at once. And firefighting 101, fire science, says that, states flashover is not a survivable event. And that's speaking to firefighters. That's not talking about a resident, a civilian that's in there without absolutely no protective equipment whatsoever. That's for a firefighter in full PPE. That if they're involved in the flashover, outside of maybe being in the doorway of it and being able to immediately get out, if you're in that room, the flashover is not a survivable event.
Yeah,
that's just a phrase. So we watch it, and it comes from first apartment, second apartment, about the third apartment that we're looking there for, this pressurized black smoke. Just and they say that whenever the smoke starts to look wet, it just picture if you have a black polyfill, solid black, shiny black, just bellowing out there, and there's no way to see through it, that all those contents, you know, the beds, chairs, there's probably still clothes, all these contents are still in that room. The windows have been, from the pressure, the window is already blown out. There's no visible fire yet at this point.
Yeah.
So we're sitting there watching that black smoke just blow out like crazy. And so I'm teaching this probationary guy, Tubby, and he's not a big guy. It's just his grandmother's nickname from when he was a baby. And he still is, to this day, he's referred to as Tubby. So I was like, Tub, pay attention to this. We're shining a flashlight on that smoke. I said, this is about to flash over the same way at those two apartments there. So it's kind of neat to be able to watch this. Even though we're watching, we need to stay on top of this. And, you know, we're staying out of the collapse zone. We're working a hand line and directing this deck gun. And we're watching this. But we're not actually, we don't have any water on this smoke right now. I have my flashlight on the smoke. We're maybe 25 feet from it. And just as this, the most intense moment before that room flashes over, a figure, and it's the way I would describe it. Let's say it was a cardboard cutout, life-size cardboard cutout, and somebody was laying in the floor, and these are great big tall windows, 7 foot tall windows, or they go almost to the floor.
Yeah.
This cardboard cutout, somebody just leaned the cardboard cutout in a fluid motion, and it was a human, and it was a woman. We could see garments blowing just slightly, almost like a dress. And it was dark. And I wouldn't say the figure was completely solid black. Leaned out, looked directly at us, and then just slowly, this was maybe over a 5 second period of just staring dead at us, and then leaned back in. Just slowly over a period of accurate leaned out. It looked at us for maybe 5 seconds, and it took about a 3 second period from maybe a 30 degree angle that the figure was leaning out the window at. And then just gradually, maybe over 3 seconds, went back in the room, and immediately once that figure got back in the room, that room immediately flashed to where the fire blew out a good 6 feet horizontally out of it. So Tubby is, he grabs me and he says, there's somebody in there. There's somebody in there. And you know, maybe as a rookie, I would think that that was, if that really was somebody, that would be a viable person to get. First of all, I knew that was not right instantaneously. I knew that startled me, no doubt about it. I knew that was not a person, at least a living flesh and blood human being that was in there. And he really thought this was somebody and thought that we were going to go in after it. And that's when you and there was a couple other people, when I'd seen his reaction to it, that he started going. He had every full intention to go in there and rescue this. All right. Let's say it was a real person. Boy, they were very, first of all, they survived the smoke inhalation. Second thing is the temperatures were probably before flashover were probably 700-800 degrees to survive that. But those two things. And absolutely nobody could survive the fire part of it. And they obviously couldn't feel pain either. So, and what we seen still had intact skin and flesh on it.
Yeah.
It was too dark to say that I could say that they were directly, that it was, I couldn't see eyes. I couldn't make out features. I couldn't really make out limbs. It was just a silhouette of a person. It was trying to get our attention and did it without speaking.
Yeah. And so this is one of the events that actually stops you from ghost hunting, because we used to ghost hunt on a regular basis.
I'm talking every night. Sure. That is absolutely one of the events that led up to that. And, you know, I feel that this thing was intentionally telling me, come on, big boy.
Yeah.
Come save me. And absolutely was telling, you know, there may have been a couple people there. If I wasn't there, it's only speculation, that there may have been some guys that went in after this thing that would have took Tubby's word that, hey, we're going to, you know, it's a mystery. I don't know. I can only tell you the details that I've seen.
Yeah.
And he and I could go back and talk to a third party before we spoke to each other. I said, you don't tell anybody an effing word about this, what you've seen. Okay. So we'll talk about it later. And then that's what we did. We did pull in a third party, actually a couple of different people that we went independently, spoke separately, and we both gave the exact same details. So it'd be interesting, like if you wanted to follow up on it, I would speak to him, and I would speak to Rico and get his take on what the hell happened at that fire.
Well, I can tell you what Rico's reaction would be. Oh, that didn't happen. I don't believe in that stuff anyway, blah, blah, blah.
Well, he also told us that something possessed him to go in that fire, and he doesn't know what it was. He had no idea why. And he was not, at this time, he was not the aggressive firefighter that he used to be. You know, he was there for a job. And, you know, that was it.
Yeah.
And there was no reason. He didn't give a shit about obviously saving that property. Pretty much none of us did. You know, risking our lives for something like that.
Yeah.
Now, only if we thought that there was an imminent threat of somebody dying in a fire, would we ever go into anything like that?
Oh, I know. I know. Like right before this happened, the only person that was living there was what was his name? He got arrested because he'd been living in Carroll for years. Earl. Now, he had been arrested.
It was the house next door, though.
Oh, was it?
It was the house next door that he was living in, but he was kind of the caretaker. They were using that as they were storing. So I'm not going to say that there weren't some crack whores or crackheads or anybody that was just flopping in that building. And I can't say without all certainty that there very well may have been somebody in there whenever this happened. And they would have perished from smoke inhalation well before. You know, this is an hour into the fire that this occurred. But that was not a flesh and blood person. That was somebody. that figure, I firmly believe, may have never walked this earth. That's just how...
So what you're saying is you think this could have been some kind of demonic entity?
You know, I won't necessarily say demonic, but malevolent, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's probably the, as far as threatening, like the scariest event that's happened to any of us. And of course, like you tell me this several weeks after it's happened, and I'm in shock. Like, okay, that's why I was stopping him from going in the house. Like, I knew he took off, and I knew it wasn't a good idea. I didn't know what he had seen.
Yeah. And several people was like, what the hell was wrong with him? And I said, you know what, I'll tell you later.
Yeah.
You know, right now is not the time to worry about that. We're just, we're not going to deal with it.
So,
and I didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah. Oh, and then, so, this is something that, you know, the people need to know. Like, at this point in time, we're dabbling in things we probably shouldn't be dabbling too much in. At the time, we didn't think it was that bad of an idea. But I know at this point in time, once to twice a week, we're having giant dowsing rod sessions at the fire station, using dowsing rods to communicate with spirits.
Right.
And we're not thinking at the moment, in the moment, that this is a bad idea. But when we think about it on it now, like, well, this is no different than doing a Ouija board. You know, this, except this was 10 to 15 of us sitting in a big circle in the fire station, which was haunted itself, opening up ourselves to whatever wanted to come in. And, you know, this is the stuff we did. And I will say, being on the fire department, we had special access to places that most people wouldn't have had permission to go to. And we did these investigations. We found things. One of my favorite places to investigate in Caro is the old Elks building.
Absolutely. Right. And there's a significant history to that place.
Well, it's been a hospital. It's been a lot.
After the hospital, it was mainly a complex to house offices.
Yeah.
Giant 5-story poured concrete and brick building, a nearly indestructible building.
Those stairs
that thing will survive the apocalypse. You know, that's how well built that this building is.
Yeah.
But it had been just a little bit of everything.
The thing I remember specifically, first day you took me in there, we get up to, was it the second or third floor? That was the Elks.
Second floor.
We get there and I just see this big open dance hall with a little bitty tiny stage on it. And, you know, you see the old kitchens in the background. I think the first time you took me in there, we even found menus from when it was still the Elks.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. But I remember us sitting up in there and doing EVP sessions. And I think it was me, you, Kristen, Hood, maybe Gerald. I know Gerald was going with us on a lot of it.
No, that wasn't on that. The EVP session, just us four.
No, the one I'm talking about, this one I'm talking about was my first time going there. I remember sitting there listening, doing the EVP session, and we actually hear somebody stomping up the steps of the building. Well, there's not supposed to be anybody in that building but us, and so we're all freaking out. And it sounds like they get to our landing, and then the steps just stop. Like, I honestly thought it was Officer Nelson coming up to talk to us, because he knew we were there.
Right. That's when we accessed the back door.
Yeah. Yes, we did.
Okay. Yep, that was that occasion.
Now, the one you're talking about, that was before you even took me there. You were just a kid. Oh, no, I wasn't on this one. This is one of those times you guys went without me. I think you took Gordy in this time.
Yeah, maybe.
But I'll let you tell this one.
I think you're right. That was I do have the picture of him. He's the one holding the thermometer in those pictures. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
So now what was this EVP? I know it, but for our listeners at home, this is interesting. Now remember that they're at the Elks Lodge, or what would have been the old Elks Lodge at the time. Dance floor, dining hall, band stage, kitchen area, and they have this happen.
Class A EVP, a woman's voice. Here comes the Pi Hubert.
And I have
very bizarre. Just not not a phrase you can confuse with any infrasound or any other BS that you can debunk it with. Clearly, here comes the Pi Hubert.
Yeah. And at the time, the only female that would have been there would have been your girlfriend, Kristen. And it definitely wasn't her voice.
No.
No,
so, it was a middle-aged woman-sounding voice.
Yeah. Which I think is, you know, all the more exciting just specifically because of where you were. Like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as far as we know in the Elks Club, nothing tragic ever happened there. Now, granted, we said the building was a hospital at one point in time. I believe it was Bondurant, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he wanted to open a hospital to compete with and put out of business the Catholic hospital that stayed in Carroll to the late 80s.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, it was converted to these office buildings. And this building was one of the reasons I came up with a theory that it doesn't have to have a tragic past to be haunted. It could be something that brought great memories to people. And the Elks Lodge is a great fraternity. And I can see people back in the days having fun with it so much so that they have a great connection with that building. So, you know, that building had a pretty big hand in getting me into the paranormal field that, you know, I'm at, where I'm at now, like, in, especially in things that I believe and try to research.
I can tell you, I never felt any time I'd ever been in there, I ever had any unpleasant, uneasy feelings, malevolent, anything negative per se that had occurred there.
Yeah,
a lot of weird things that happened. I wish some of the a lot of things. Whenever I share my experiences, I don't typically share anything that I cannot corroborate. Any of the claims with,
yeah.
But that is the interesting one I had by myself was as a teenager when I went in there and I heard the big band playing.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman, something going on. Full blown early 1940s swing music live. Going on upstairs of that building from the first floor.
Yeah. Now, at this point in time, you didn't have any interest in aliens or in ghosts at the time. I know at this point in time you're more interested in aliens. It was the 90s, you know. That's all anybody
worried
about.
That was probably the point in time I really didn't really have any interest in anything paranormal, really.
Yeah.
You know, the Unsolved Mysteries is 100% responsible whenever that started in the late 80s, for scaring the hell out of me with any alien related things.
Yeah.
So no, that wasn't even on my radar thinking about that as a teenager going in there and trying to find some cool stuff.
Yeah. You know,
that was about it.
That goes along. I mean, like for me, one of the coolest places to go into in Carroll is the hospital. And I never, it was closed before I was born, I think. What year did it close? 89?
I'm going to say 87 is when the hospital itself, how can I put this? Essentially, Lourdes Hospital actually bought that hospital out.
Yeah.
And they ran it for maybe a year or so. And essentially, they ran out of money and they took and locked the doors. They kept as an inpatient facility. So there's no inpatient, none of the rooms, surgery, none of that was labor and delivery, nothing. They just locked that up and sealed that off. However, they kept the emergency room open for maybe a year and a half, 2 years. I'm not sure. That was before I moved to Caro. I didn't move to Caro until November of 89. So it was somewhere before that, but shortly before that.
Yeah,
but I never lived in Caro whenever that hospital was open.
And I was telling a friend of this story recently because I took her. She wanted to check out the hospital, and I took her and showed her some of the places. But I was telling her how it actually looked, because I think what was about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, they went in and cleaned everything out.
Yeah, about 10 years ago.
Yeah. But the crazy thing about it is when he says they locked the doors, they literally locked the doors and left.
Yeah. Yeah.
They left. They left everything.
So you still had biological material, body parts.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say like arms and legs, but maybe like a gallbladder or uterus or something, was still just left in the biohazard. Instruments were still left in the autoclave. They were still left in the dirty utility rooms. All the drugs were in there. Blood that was being ran in the lab was still left in the centrifuge.
Yep.
And it is literally, they took the keys and just turned the deadbolts on it. So, every IV pump, monitor, ventilator, anything you could think of, you just go to any hospital today and just kick the patients out, staff out, and lock the doors.
And that's exactly what happened.
Exactly what happened.
I know they were finding different birth records, death records of patients that, you know, the hospital kept stored there 10 years ago when they were cleaning it out. I know they were finding freshly empty bottles of morphine and stuff back in the 90s that they had left there. And I partially blame the hospital for the opioid crisis in Cairo back in the 90s, like how it got started. Because all it took was people to break
that
place.
I'm sure it's responsible for. Oh yeah, I'm sure that it's responsible for several deaths.
Yeah.
That people getting the volumes of morphine and Demerol, that volume that you could get, and people not being aware of what it would take to kill you, not knowing how to reverse it. Not like they took a bottle of Narcan, of naloxone, you know, with them whenever they did that. So yeah, I'm sure it actually did kill a lot of people. Because there, we did find empty Tubex syringes. These were little pre-filled syringes that you used to lock in. Used to have a reusable syringe type thing.
Mm-hmm.
That and the cartridge already had the needle on it. We found a just like you would look in the streets of San Francisco with the needles, you know, all over the street. This is what those rooms looked like. Just those empty meperidine, the generic Demerol. All those being empty.
Yeah, and I mean that's so. That hospital's got a lot of dark history to it. But so the night that I met the ghost hunters and I went in there, I was telling them about the history of the town, the history of the building, and they thought it was fascinating enough. They asked me if I wanted to stay and investigate with them. And I said, well, absolutely. So. They gave me a they gave me a thermal camera, one of the small handheld ones. That's like if you want to save a photo, you can hit the trigger and it freezes the frame. And we start off in the cafeteria, which is on the first floor there. And then we end up going up to the third floor, which is the operating room and the maternity ward. And while we're in the operating rooms, they're doing an EVP session, and I'm standing outside looking back towards the stairwell. This is a terrible description for people who don't know the hospital, but Brandon will understand it. So I'm standing in the operating rooms looking down the hallway towards the stairwell, right? And you've got the recovery and sterilizing rooms on the right-hand side,
mm-hmm.
with the nurse's station on the left-hand side. So at some point in time, because I kept thinking I'm hearing something down the hallway, and I take the thermal and I put it up looking in the hallway, and I see a warmer than air figure come from the recovery, cleaning, sterilizing room, and run across the hall into the nurse's station, like where the locker room is. And it's so fast I didn't have time to actually hit the trigger and freeze it. And, you know, went in there, check everything out. There's nobody in there. Can't find anything. It was weird. It was like, it's a random warmer than air object moving across the hallway. So I tell them about that. We try to investigate it. Don't find anything else. So we go down the hall and back around to the maternity ward, like where, if you go to any hospital now, they have the big viewing rooms where they have all the babies set out, and there's the big room. It's basically two rooms with the big viewing glass. And I had recently come up with a theory, and I'm sure somebody else had a theory, it just came to me at that time, that if you're in a place where somebody had had a huge effect on the area, on that place, that saying their name or bringing them up can, you know, cause things to happen. Well, it just so happens that one of my best friends, her grandmother, was the woman who delivered probably 90% of the children in that hospital. Shalom Reisinger?
She was a nurse for 50 years there.
Yeah. Yeah, this is back in the day when the nurses did most of the work.
Right, right. And she probably had 50 children of her own.
Jesus Christ.
Wasn't that, man? But she had a lot of kids.
I know the twins, Agnes, Charlotte, it's a lot of them. I think six or seven.
Yeah.
So we started doing an EVP session, and they had one of the light up EMF detectors, but this one when it would light up, it meters, so green, yellow, red. When it hit red, it would beep, like in a warning saying, "Hey, there's too much electricity coming out of here. It's kind of dangerous. You need to figure this out." Which, you know, for people who are listening who aren't entirely sure about these are devices that are actually used by electricians. This is not a tool built by ghost hunters for anything. This is used by electricians. It measures electricity in the air. That's the easiest way to describe this machine. And it works best in a building that has no electricity run to it at all. So, they put the EMF detector in the window, in the viewing window for the maternity there. And I tell them my theory, and so I start out the conversation with, you know, "Hello, my name's Tanner. You know, we just want to try to communicate with you. We've got two devices in the window. And I know somebody who used to work here. So, you know, does anybody know Shalom Reisinger?" At the completion of saying her name, the EMF detector hammers to red and beeps. There's not been any electrical cables hooked to this building since it was shut down. And I'm in the dead center of the building on the third floor, so there's definitely no electricity close by that's going to affect this machine.
Well, the building is also completely void of copper.
Yeah.
From the vandals over the years, there's not a penny's worth of copper in that building. I promise you.
So I continue talking. You know, I'm just talking, and I'm not saying her name anymore, and it's not hitting. And so I stopped, give a break for the EVP session. I said, "Is Shalom here?" And again, as soon as I say Shalom, it hammers to red, beeps. So I decided to go with it. I'm like, "Shalom, hammer, beep. You know, I'm a friend of your granddaughter's, Jennifer's, hammers, beeps. You know, I know Jennifer very well, and I knew Agnes very well, hammers, beeps." Every time I would bring up, I would say Jennifer, Agnes, or Shalom, this thing would go off. And it was an amazing experience, but I could tell they had somebody new on the team, Jessica, she may listen to this, because she was actually freaking out while it was happening. But that was one of the coolest experiences I've ever had ghost hunting. Like, I've caught things before, but never, like, I feel that's probably the most concrete evidence I've ever found, and I can't think of a way to debunk it. Like, I don't see how anybody could, unless they just try to say, "Well, maybe the machine was malfunctioning, and it's not going off anywhere else." You know, people say it's not real, but, you know, for me it was real, and that's all the evidence I needed.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and on the other spectrum, end of the spectrum, you know, I've been in that building, I would guess 50 times as a closed building. My mom used to work in the building. My mom was a nurse's aide there. My dad worked his entire life in Caro. So even though I lived in Mounds, Caro is where we, I was in Caro two or three times a week. So, but being in there is a vacant structure, maybe 40, 50 times, absolutely nothing that I could remark on.
And that's the thing. Up until this moment, with the ghost hunters, I've been in there four or five times with you, and I have never had anything paranormal happen there.
Yeah.
And funny enough, I think I told you this in one of our dinners, but Anthony had actually showed up. And for those listening, Anthony is our postmaster in Caro. Sweet guy. Very, very sweet. Over flirtatious with certain firefighters. But he actually showed up about an hour before I did to talk to the ghost hunters because he lives right there. And flat out tells him, you know, he's a witch.
His father was a physician. His father was a well-respected physician there for many years.
Really? I didn't know that.
And Dr. Homer Chambliss.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, he goes telling the ghost, that, you know, the team that's there, that, you know, he's a witch and they're not going to find anything. And they said, do you know the big guy that lives across the street? And I thought Anthony had moved, but apparently he's still there. And I said, no. And I start describing him. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's Anthony. He's our postmaster. He goes, well, they said he came over here was talking to us, telling us he's a witch and that we ain't going to find nothing in this building. I'm like, from personal experience, I've never had anything happen here yet, but we'll see what we can get.
Yeah.
But it ended up being a great night. That actually led us into getting an investigation at the courthouse at Pulaski County. So that was an experience. But, I'm trying to think of any other, you know, experiences we've had that would be good talking for the show because, I mean, we've had so many. But even just sitting out on the front apron of the fire department and watching lights turn on in the custom house, which, for people who don't know, the customs house in Caro is now a museum, but it used to be exactly what it's called, a customs house and post office and courthouse.
Yeah.
And it's actually a pretty great place. If you're ever driving through Caro and you want to see a history of a really interesting town, it's a cool place to check. But it is actually haunted. I wish Fred Shelton was still around, you know, talk to him about it. Even though he would go off on tangents of other things, he could still tell you stories about things happening there. But, we all used to sit out in front of the apron and we'd sit out there just to watch the lights turn off and on the third floor or second floor.
Mm-hmm.
And it still happens. I'll catch myself going to work sometimes down there at 10 o'clock at night and I'll look up and there's lights on. And I know it's been closed all day, so why are the lights on? But there's little gyms like that all around this area. As soon as the pandemic is over, Shannon and I are planning on getting our teams together and we're gonna do this. We're gonna go out and investigate these places, you know. Video evidence, you know, audio evidence. We may try to do a live podcast there one time. Everything's kind of up in the air. And I'll say the same thing I say at the end of every I Want to Believe. You know, if you guys have, you know, any other places that, you know, you want to let us know about, places you think we would enjoy investigating, please reach out to us, you know, at literally anything at podzilla1985.com and we'll get it. Or you can hit us on Facebook. We want to hear from the people who have these places, have these experiences. You know, we enjoy this. You know, this is fun for us, and it's I don't want to say educational because, you know, we can't really apply it to anything real world, but it's comforting, I guess, is a weird way to put it. So, Brandon, do you have anything else you wanted to talk about?
Well, we really got off on really a tangent into the spiritual side of it. That took forever and got off on that, but we're talking with 37th Parallel. I even have a cryptid that of my own, which I can cooperate with Brandon Hall, the guy we call Ton.
Yep.
We weren't together. We were traveling back to back. I just happened to see him. I was leaving Cape. I seen him probably there around Rhodes, by state, that area, you know, acknowledge it. He seen me and I was behind him. And of course we on our way back to Caro. We're right a couple car lengths away. I'm right behind him. Coming to before we get to the Gale area, the Gale Bridge, the levee that you would start cresting, we start seeing the vehicle that was in front of us started slowing down.
Yeah.
And of course there, it's right at dusk. I mean, it's at at that time of day where you really can't see a damn thing. You got to have your headlights on, but still you can't. It's just that point that, and everybody knows what I'm talking about, the twilight and dusk, where there's that point that you just cannot see crap. And there's somebody slowing down, and a car coming the opposite direction is just coming down that little bit of that hill where the levee is, before you get to the Gale Bridge. I could see a silhouette. And here in that area, I mean, whenever you see a silhouette of something standing in the road, what do you think? Well, you probably think it's a deer.
Yeah.
And that's exactly, and I see it, the silhouette, and everybody's slowing down. I got a damn stupid-ass deer standing in the road there, and it's just standing there. And the closer I start to get, I start seeing a ton hitting his brakes. And I'm looking, and I see the silhouette, and I say, that's a dog. That's a big-ass dog. And crept up, and I ton almost came to a stop. And I'm looking, in contrast to the size of his vehicle, and he had a Ford Ranger. He had that Ford Ranger at that time. And I'm like, oh, this dog is effing huge, absolutely huge. And I'm thinking, oh my God, we may be looking at a wolf. And I see him almost come to a stop, and he just takes he takes off after stopping. And that dog never moved. Didn't seem to move an inch. It's standing in the oncoming lane, standing with his head pretty close to center line.
Yeah.
I crept up to it. I'm almost at a crawl because I'm not knowing what it's going to do. And I see the size of the dog. The wolf, at this point, I'm determined that this is a wolf. And as I'm getting closer to it, I'm in the Trailblazer.
Yeah.
The head of this animal, its head is approximately on the center line, facing the west. So it's facing me. And I get maybe 5 feet off of center line at that point. As I'm creeping up to it, it's still standing there. Absolutely motionless. Absolutely nothing. It might as well have been a statue, for all that's concerned. It's just there. As I'm creeping up onto it, the muzzle of this dog is eye level with me. This is sitting in a Trailblazer.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a normal dog. This is the size of a pony. And I'm not going to say it's solid black, but it was at least dark brown. I really can't make out the time of day that it was.
Yeah.
As I came up, and it was at my, I did not turn my head until I made it to about the 9 o'clock position of my head turning. The eyes of this beast was, and it's not, I can't use the words glowing. Glowing is, whenever you think of glowing, you think of Hollywood, where you got that red LED almost looking eyes. Inside its pupils, the only way I could describe it would be inside the skull was a dimly lit, like a tea light candle, very small candle.
Yeah.
That glow, that flicker emanated from its eyes. Absolutely gave me chills. You know, the hair stain on the back of your neck, yeah, all that shit happened. And it happened really quick. And I got the hell out of there. I kept looking in my mirror thinking this thing is still, it never directed its vision towards me. It's not like it turned its eyes, its head did not rotate. It was just that moment that we made eye contact when I made that 90-degree turn and looked at my 3 o'clock, I'm sorry, my 9 o'clock, looked at that, and you know, we made that eye contact and seen that glow, that flicker in its eyes. And of course, and I don't know if anybody would have just stopped there and had a conversation with the damn thing. And I took the hell off. I watched it in my mirror, and it still stood there motionless until I got completely out of sight. I went up that hill and around the curve across the Gale Bridge. And of course I'm frantically, I'm clear of this thing, that I'm frantically trying to call a ton. Well, of course, right there at the thieves' bottoms there.
Yeah.
There, that's where the cell phone always drops. I mean, I guess it probably still does. But you cannot.
Not as bad.
Anyway, it may not be as bad, but you know, at that time there was, there was a 3 mile stretch or so that you just did not have service at all. And so unbeknownst to me, he's seen the same thing. He is frantically trying to call me. And in any way, it doesn't happen until we get up to about Rock Springs Road that we're still trying to call each other. And I forget which one of us contacted each other first. And exactly. And he said, I know you've seen that fucking wolf. And he described exactly the same thing that I did. So trying to figure out what the heck this was, if this is a possibility that really could have been a wolf, if it was just a refraction of the sunset, because it was facing, the sun was down. It wasn't the actual physical sun. You could still see the glow from dusk, the reflection off the clouds and stuff, but the sun was not physically there to reflect. For that, to debunk it in that way, to figure out what that light was in its eyes. And so Googling this and right now you could Google, large 4 foot or whatever, 5 foot tall wolf, black wolf, glowing eyes. And want to take a guess at what comes up?
What is that?
Skinwalker.
Really?
And that's one of the most common, skinwalkers. And that goes back to, Apache, Ute, and Navajo all have that. That is their, that's their type of skinwalker. There's an extinct species or an extinct animal, a wolf, canine species, that's called a dire wolf, D-I-R-E, it's the counterpart to the saber-toothed tiger, the saber-toothed cat, goes back to the Ice Age. That's the closest to any dog ever being that size. And in their legend, that's the reincarnation of the dire wolf into their spirits. Now, I don't know if that goes into, you can't find a lot about history in Shawnee lore, even Cherokee, with those spirit animals. You know, most of that are those Western natives that dabble into the skinwalker. I'm sure to some degree that they have spirits like that too. But that was just absolutely crazy that skinwalker is what that matched.
I mean, this area has a rich history in Native Americans, not just with the Shawnee and the Cherokee, the Mississippians, especially in the area you were in. The Mississippians ruled that area back in the day.
That's right. I take that back. The Mississippians is where, in Thebes, they had a large find of 10,000-year-old artifacts.
And they're still pillaging.
There's a whole treasure trove.
Yeah, it's a piece of property where if you go out with a spade shovel right now and you turn up one scoop of dirt, you're going to find an arrowhead or a spearhead or an axe. You're going to find something, some kind of artifact. It's saturated with Mississippian artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for anybody who doesn't know, there's the same tribe that built Cahokia Mounds near St. Louis. That goes into a whole conspiracy theory with the Mayans and all kinds of stuff. It's a really interesting story. But yeah, it's that area you described, that was a very large Mississippian settlement in that area. So I don't know what kind of legends they had with something like that, but it'd be worth looking up, I guess.
Yeah.
So we'll have to do the research on that. I personally haven't had any cryptid experiences myself. I've tried. I've heard of a Bigfoot-like creature in the hills out around Wagner's Hill, which we've talked about in the show before, me and Shannon. Never found anything. Of course, there's all kinds of weird creatures like that are reported to be out in that area. For God's sakes, everybody swears up and down there's an actual panther that's out there. So,
yeah, there's actually in that same area that my creature was at. There was either a Discovery or Travel Channel. There's an Alexander County cat story.
Okay.
That apparently happened in the 70s, which is it's basically a giant black panther.
Okay.
And I didn't get to see it. Actually, a couple people told me that they've seen it. I've Googled trying to find a couple different ways to search it, but I can't come up with any results, and maybe you could find out. But there is an Alexander County cat story that's essentially a giant panther that is most likely not of this earth, not a typical panther, cougar, mountain lion, puma, whatever, what have you. It's maybe double that size.
Let's see. I'm actually going to Google it right now, because I know we've discussed in the past the Caro Bigfoot sightings and the flying saucer sightings, which the flying saucer in Caro, it blows my mind, because one day they're, you know, this is serious, you know, they're, you know, a lot of people are reporting this to the police talking about they've seen it, and then the very next day they're making jokes about it in the newspaper talking about the IRS is looking for them. Or that was a Bigfoot. Regardless, you know, they're making these jokes now, and it's, you know, why are yesterday were you very serious about it, and all of a sudden now you're making jokes?
Right. So, right. It's almost the Roswell story with them backpedaling. And
yeah. So, you know, it's very interesting. I'm looking up right now and not finding anything yet. I'm going to have to keep looking on this, and whenever I find it, I'll send it to you if I find anything, and then we'll talk about it next time we have you on, because I definitely want to have you back. This has been a really fun show.
Yeah.
So, and maybe when I get, because some of these guests I'm going to have, that, you know, Shannon just doesn't know that, you know, I think he'd be a really good partner to have in the interview, so I'd like to have you back for some of them.
Yeah,
I think you'd be fun to have with Margie K. I think you'd have more. Yeah. You know, you'd have something to offer for that. So, yeah. Anyway,
do you want the aerial phenomenon real quick? It's quick.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. We own the network. We can go as long as we want.
Yeah. Let's say this is about 94. It's a friend of mine named Justin Allen. He was from the Detroit area. He lived in Carroll with his aunt, who lived on 39th Street, directly behind the shed. There's a couple little houses there. She was a nurse practitioner he lived with his aunt, and that's how he found his way to Carroll. After church on Sunday night at Carroll Baptist, for some reason that night they canceled, the gym was canceled. This is when they used to go up to the Bondrian gym, after church on Sunday nights.
Oh, I miss those swimming days.
We walked. So I'm only about three blocks from Carroll Baptist, and I walk to my house, and we're going to walk all the way. This is from 7th Street. We're walking all the way to 39th Street. That's a pretty good, in the middle of the night, that's kind of risky for some 14 to 15 year olds to be walking. So as soon as we pass we go ahead and cross the street and start walking on that side of the road on the highway. Okay. As soon as we pass Carroll Citizen, we get in that gap of 8th Street, and he says, "What the hell is that?" And he nudges me, and he points and turns me around, and I turn around and I start looking, probably about, it's directly over Barkett Funeral Home, so I'm turning into my left to about my 8 o'clock, and I'm looking up, and let's go about 30 degrees in the sky, that a yellow triangle is present. And it's not... When we're looking at it, we stare at it. We're sitting there. We're thinking, we're not little kids, but we're trying to think more objectively and trying to give us, what the hell could that be? Is it, you know how you can look to sometimes the moon breaks through the clouds?
Yeah.
And you get a weird shape and it, you know, it kind of startle you, and then you realize, oh, it's just a break in the cloud. That's just, and well, what we were looking at was, well, it was fairly high in the sky. 30 to 40 degrees in the sky, not down the horizon where it's going to have that, where the blue light is filtered and, the moon would be that yellow color, that orange color. It's more of a pastel yellow, but it's a perfect triangle. It's an isosceles. It's not even lateral. It was wider at the base, and then where it made the point, those were, it was symmetrical, but it was kind of a squatty looking triangle, and it was this pastel yellow color, but it wasn't an object. It was a hole. We were looking at a triangular shaped hole in the sky. So if you could picture the sky being a piece of black fabric,
okay,
and stretched, and then a hole cut in, a triangular shaped hole cut in it, and then a wall directly behind that, a few feet, and then it's illuminated yellow. That's what the hell we've seen. Hmm. And so it's kind of scaring us, so we get to walking faster. Now, there used to be buildings there between St. Pat's Church and the citizens, so that entire block here is completely obscured.
Yeah.
Well, and then it was still obscured by some trees where we walked completely. So their Daystar Community Program and where that soup kitchen area is, it opens up, and there it was again. It was still there.
Huh.
So, now.
It was just kind of stationary?
Absolutely. Absolutely never moved. And it didn't seem, I really couldn't put contrast the distance that it was. It certainly wasn't over Cairo. It was over Missouri. And it was, this could have been something that was 40 miles away, but the thing was 10 miles wide.
Yeah.
I don't know. It didn't seem like it was, it certainly was not a three-dimensional object in our atmosphere. It was, the way I describe it, it had the reverse of 3D. The depth of it was the opposite, the absolute opposite. We were looking in a hole. I mean, I guess it was a something three-dimensional to get that perspective, but it was I was looking at the absence of something. I was looking at the absence of space in a triangular shape. So that's the only way I can describe it.
Almost sounds more like a portal than anything.
I would love to talk to him and kind of get his perspective on what he, now that going back, looking, seeing what the hell he thinks of that thing was. But that's the best way that I could describe it. Yeah. And after a few blocks, we had an obstructive view pretty much the rest of the walk that we, there went, by the time that we got to the fire station area, it had disappeared.
Yeah.
So
I think I found what you were talking about.
Okay.
And now I kind of want to reach out to the person that talks about it. I don't know where he's at now. Mike Busby. He's friends with a lot of my family, so I'm going to try to reach out. But
yeah, I know Michael Jean.
So
yes, if you search, I'm sure there's another Mike Busby, but there's Michael Jean Busby is the one that's a little bit older than me. Yeah.
Well, this event took place in 1970.
Okay, that may be his dad. It may be a dad or an uncle or something, but I'm sure that he would know.
So this is the story. Perhaps one of the weirdest incidents occurred at the extreme southern tip of in the state in Alexander County. On Friday, April 10th, 1970, Mike Busby of Cairo was driving on Route 3 to Olive Branch to pick up his wife. At about 8:30 p.m., a mile south of Olive Branch on this dark, mostly deserted road that parallels the edge of the vast Shawnee National Forest, Busby's automobile quit running. He got out of his car and had begun to release the hood latch when he heard a noise to his left. He was startled to see two quarter-sized almond-shaped greenish glowing eyes staring at him. Excuse me. Before he had a chance to move, the strange form, 6 feet tall, black, and upright, advanced on him without warning. It hit him hard in the face with two large padded front feet, and they rolled over together to the left side of the road. It, in quotation marks, remained on top of Busby as the two tumbled, shredding his shirt to pieces. It inflicted wounds on his left arm, chest, and abdomen with dull 2-inch claws. Busby desperately held his mouth open at arm's length, certain that it was trying for his throat. He tried to keep clear of its long, yellow canines. So in that description, it sounds kind of like a bear. The story goes on and describes it with a long tail, actually saying it was more like a cat. So whatever this was, it was a large cat that was on its hind legs when it attacked him. He got a good view of it when a truck driver, or a semi-truck, went by and put his lights on it. Busby was eventually taken to St. Mary's Hospital, and here we go again, in Cairo, and was treated by Dr. Robinson, who gave him two inoculations, one for tetanus and another for relief of pain. Busby's brother, Don, told me that in the days following the encounter, Mike required aid in walking and was often dizzy and fainted once.
Huh.
So.
What source did you get that from?
This is on Crypto Zoo News, Illinois Cryptids.
Okay.
I'll send it to you. Just, you'll have to search
for
Caro in it, and you'll find it pretty easily. But, I mean, the guy I'm looking at definitely looks like he'd be that age. But the picture is from he's posted a picture 13 hours ago. And he's friends with a bunch of people from Caro, so I'm going to have to assume this is him. So, I might have to reach out to this person and see if it was him. I want to get this story. This is interesting. This is a chance to get a first-hand story of a cryptid in Alexander County. That's exciting.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, this show has opened up doors for more stuff, and it's so super exciting. So, Brandon, I got to have you back soon, man. Like, I really do need you back for one of these interviews coming up soon. It's been fun. Especially now that we've had to have a way to do these remote interviews where, you know, we don't have to be in the same room to do it.
Right.
So, anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in to Podzilla 1985 and I Want to Believe. For myself, for Brandon, we want to say, you know, thank you for tuning in. This has been a great show. If you have any other information, any stories, any places you'd like to check out, please reach out to us. You know all the ways. And for myself, Brandon, have a good night. Keep your eyes in the sky.
Thank you. Good night.